Welcome to Power Play. I'm Evan Solomon. On the program today, should flights from India be banned due to a new COVID variant? And should the federal government take over provincial controls?
Border measures immediately means that the third wave could last until June.
Will the Prime Minister declare a public welfare emergency and immediately get the help that people need, getting vaccines to those who need it most?
Why are so many international flights still allowed to come to Canada with passengers infected with COVID? Should Canada follow the UK's example and temporarily ban flights from countries like India after that new mutant strain has just been found there and now here? And why are flights in that country still landing? Also, after President Joe Biden and the Prime Minister spoke today, will the US be shipping vaccines to Canada? We're going to ask the Public Safety Minister, Bill Blair, when he joins us in a minute. And then the George Floyd verdict. George Floyd was murdered, but why was the verdict in this case so rare?
It should be the beginning of this nation figuring out that we all can live with each other.
Former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin was found guilty of murdering George Floyd. Why was this such a rare verdict? Does Canada even collect the right information on police killings? Black Lives Matter Toronto co-founder Sandy Hudson and the University of Toronto professor who studies this, Akwasio Wasubempa, join us with the impact of that verdict on Canada. Plus, we're standing by for a confidence vote. Check this out.
The fact that they are making that a confidence vote and not just the budget itself, which is, of course, a confidence vote, but they're making amendments as well, is a clear indication on top of a whole bunch of other indications that this Liberal government and Justin Trudeau are looking for an excuse to go to an election.
Government could follow this out with a vote on opposition amendments to the federal government, but the NDP is poised to vote with the government. So not a lot of drama. We're watching it closely. But what incentive does the government have to change their budget if the NDP have already given it their vote? We'll give you the latest on that. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. So is vaccine finally help coming from the U.S.? Well, that's the signal that the U.S. President Joe Biden sent today after he spoke to Prime Minister Trudeau for 30 minutes. And while they spoke about a number of key issues like the imprisonment of the two Michaels, the upcoming climate summit later this week, given the third wave of COVID crushing so much of this country, and the vaccine scarcity issue here, it was news on that front that was most interesting. Let me show you what President Biden said after their call.
I've talked to our neighbors. As a matter of fact, a fellow who's working really hard to take care of his country and deal with this, I was on the phone with for about half an hour today. And the Prime Minister of Canada, we helped a little bit there. We're going to try to help some more. But there's other countries as well that I'm confident we can help, including in Central America. And but it's in process. We don't have enough to be confident to give it, send it abroad now. But I expect we're going to be able to do that.
So I reached out to a source in the Prime Minister's office to see if that signal that the U.S. will actually start to ship vaccines to Canada soon. The U.S., after all, is sitting on tens of millions of unused doses of AstraZeneca because they have not approved it. The U.S. has already provided Canada with 1.5 million doses of that vaccine, but Canada has ordered 20 million of that product. And the U.S. is about to face a very rare problem, a surplus of key vaccines like Pfizer and Moderna, as their population is getting vaccinated rapidly. But the source inside the Prime Minister's office said Canada is encouraged by the comments, but nothing on vaccines is confirmed at this time. Remember, Canada has now vaccinated 25% of the population with at least one dose. That's about 10 million doses, but it's not nearly enough in the deadly race between the vaccine and the new variants. The variants are clearly winning in key parts of the country like Ontario, BC and Quebec. And that's why today there are calls for Canada to shut down air travel from countries like India, where there's a new double mutant strain on COVID emerging. A case was just found in Quebec. Why are flights from India arriving with infected passengers? And should those flights be stopped as the UK did on Friday? Let's find out. Joining me now is the Public Safety Minister, Bill Blair. Minister, always good to have you on the program. Let me just start with vaccines. As I said, the U.S. is sitting on millions of doses of AstraZeneca. They haven't approved it. They're not using it. On the call, did the Prime Minister insist that Canada get more access to vaccines that we've actually bought and paid for, 20 million of them?
Well, I mean, as you know, we've been working full out to get vaccines into Canada. We were very successful in the month of March. The original schedule of delivery indicated we would get 6 million doses. We managed to get 9.5. Minister Anand has been working globally right around the country. We know there's a global competition for these vaccines. But for example, the Prime Minister just announced last Friday that we've been able to secure 8 million additional doses to be delivered before the end of June. And that's over and above what was already promised. And although there are some...
No, but this is the U.S.
And in his conversation today, the Prime Minister clearly raised the issue of Canada's strong desire to acquire additional doses of vaccines for Canadians. And we've received some very positive support from the President. And those discussions will go forward, and they'll go forward with the urgency that I think all Canadians feel, to get as many vaccines as quickly into this country, because we know that they can make a difference. And until that, right, that important job is done, Evan, it's also really important to continue to emphasize the importance of public health measures and guidelines that have been put in place in order to stop this within communities.
Okay, but Minister, did the Prime Minister specifically say to the President, you are not using life-saving vaccines, you haven't approved them, we want them, we've got them, give us the 20 million doses or a big chunk of those 20 million doses of AstraZeneca that you're sitting on in a factory because we're dying here. Did he specifically make that request?
You know, Evan, I wasn't on the call, but I've read a readout of the call, and I've heard the Prime Minister speak about his conversation with the President. I think the Prime Minister made it crystal clear that we urgently seek to attain additional doses of vaccine, including the AstraZeneca vaccine. He asked for help from the President, and the President in his comments or later on this afternoon. Mm. We're very supportive of the Prime Minister's efforts to secure those doses. We're going to continue to do the job of working with them to get vaccines into this country as quickly as we can.
Okay, we just lost a bit of your visual there, but we got your audio, so I'm going to keep you on, Minister, as we just try to clear up that technical difficulty.
I think I came back, Evans. People were phoning me at the same time.
Okay, there you go.
If you can imagine, it's a busy afternoon.
Listen, I bet it's busy. Just one last thing on this before we move on to other things. Premier Brian Pallister from Manitoba is going to join us in a minute. He's clearly cut a deal with North Dakota. North Dakota is going to vaccinate and pay for up to 4,000 truckers across the border. Okay? If he can negotiate a deal with North Dakota to get the Americans to send a surplus of Pfizer vaccines for 4,000 Canadians, why can't the federal government do the same?
Yeah, no. To be really clear, I think it's great what the North Dakota and the premier in Manitoba have worked out. Those truck drivers travel back and forth between our countries and between those two, the provincial and state jurisdiction. And so it's in the interest of both jurisdictions to vaccinate those people as quickly as possible. I think my hat's off to the premier for negotiating that deal. We're working hard in Canada to protect all Canadians as quickly as possible to obtain sufficient vaccines. You know, and we're making real progress. You know, I understand as of today, 25% of Canadians have now had access to at least one dose. And we know from the scientific evidence that one dose can prevent serious illness, hospitalization, and even death. And so we're going to continue to move on this as quickly as possible. And I applaud the work that Premier Pallister did in negotiating this with his colleague in North Dakota.
How safe are Canadians feeling when the UK banned flights from India on Friday because of the new strain, this double mutant strain? In the last 14 days, 117 international flights with one or more infected passenger has landed here in Canada, 117. 29 of those flights, at least, have come from Delhi, India. You know that variants have come from overseas. Why is your government not immediately grounding those flights like the UK from India until you can figure out what the heck is going on?
Yeah, thanks very much, Evan. Let me explain exactly what we do. Look, we have implemented some of the strongest measures anywhere in the world, even stronger than in the UK. We require, for example, everyone flying into this country to prior to boarding a plane to submit a negative test. We test them again upon arrival. Upon arrival, we then put them into government assisted accommodation for quarantine. We require them to engage in a 14-day quarantine, and we also require a subsequent test post-arrival before that quarantine ends. You know, we've put some very strong measures. We essentially banned non-essential travel into this country more than a year ago, but we know that there are Canadians flying back. I will tell you, Evan, that we were among the first countries in the world to actually ban flights from the UK when the UK variant first emerged in the United Kingdom.
I understand that, but let me just focus on this. But despite what you're saying about the system, it's clearly not working. I spoke to Dr. Brian Conway, the medical director of Vancouver Infectious Disease Center, and he said, however rigorous you think the system is, here's the facts. Someone is testing negative when they get on a plane in Delhi and then positive when they get into Canada. So that means there's a screw up on one end. Number two, variants come from overseas. What you've banned from the UK in December for 2 weeks, why not now ban it from India before this double mutant arrives? And I know we've had one case in Quebec. Ban it now, and then if it's you figure it out, then you can ease it up. Time matters. Why not ground the flights?
And Evan, I agree time matters, and we approach this with great urgency. I mentioned it's been a busy afternoon. I can tell you that we are very actively working on identifying ways in which we can stop those variants from coming from other countries. We have a number of tools to consider, the use of notice to airmen, where we can actually ground those flights. There are additional measures we can take to ensure, for example, we deal more effectively when people present falsified test results. We have some very strong measures in the world, but I think we've demonstrated that we're more than willing, and we act with alacrity in imposing additional measures. I can confirm for you that we are very actively considering all and any additional measures that will be necessary to protect Canadians, and I hope that we'll be able to explain to share more of that with you in the next 24 hours or so.
Okay, I just want to clarify right now. You're saying that your government is now actively considering banning certain flights from India, and in the next 24 hours, you will have a decision on that?
Yeah, what I can tell you is we have previously banned flights from areas where there was a high incidence of infection, and particularly with the new variants, and we are actively considering the use of very similar tools. Those tools, again, we've demonstrated our willingness and ability to use those tools to protect Canadians, and we're still quite prepared to do that. And there's work ongoing on that, and we'll have more to say on that.
Just quickly, can I clarify, is there a problem with pre-flight testing, Bill Blair? Like people getting tested and that test is flawed and they can actively get it on the flight? What is it?
Well, no, the reality is, you know, a test taken within 72 hours of departure on the plane, unfortunately, people can become symptomatic or become infected in that ensuing 72 hours. It's why we test them again when they land. Like we do, we actually test them three times in this process, Evan. We test them before they get on the plane. We test them again upon arrival. We put them into quarantine. We enforce our quarantine, and then we test them again at the 10-day mark. And all of those measures are really important to ensure that infected people aren't out in community.
Okay. Bill Blair, I know I got 30 seconds with you. Jagmeet Singh is asking the federal government to invoke the Emergency Act to help provinces like Ontario because the third wave is so devastating there. Is your government considering invoking that, which would really be to take over a lot of the responsibility in terms of the response on the vaccination and the COVID front?
Yeah, and let me be very clear. The Prime Minister spoke about this on Friday. We've been working with the provinces and territories. This has been a very collaborative, all hands on deck, Team Canada effort to respond to outbreaks where they've taken place. We saw this weekend that Ontario has additional requirements, and a lot of the other provinces have put up their hand and said, we're willing to help. And the Canadian government has stepped in to facilitate the mobility of people. We're going through our own resources to see how we can help. We're all in this together, and we'll continue to do. And we've agreed to over 68, I think, requests for assistance from the provinces for assistance. We're going to be there. We stand by ready to help Ontario if they need our help.
All right, Bill Blair, I really appreciate the time. I know you got a busy day. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, mate.
That's the Minister of Public Safety. Just really interesting there. In the next 24 hours, we could find out if Canada's going to ban flights from countries like India because of the variants. So, you know, time matters there. But we also found out that while Mr. Trudeau is negotiating with President Biden about that to get more vaccines, Manitoba has already decided to go it alone. They inked their own deal with neighboring North Dakota yesterday. Premier Brian Pallister announced a joint vaccination initiative with the U.S. state through the Essential Workers Cross-Border Vaccination Initiative. An estimated 2,000 to 4,000 Manitoba-based truck drivers will now get vaccinated in North Dakota, and North Dakota will provide the first and second shots to eligible drivers who are making that cross-border trip. And they're also in talks with Saskatchewan to do the same thing. Good news for Manitoba. But how does this all work? And who's paying for it? I spoke with the Manitoba Premier, Brian Pallister, yesterday. Listen to this. Joining us now, the Premier of Manitoba, Brian Pallister. Premier,
I am.
Man, extracting any vaccines out of the United States has been a tough nut to crack. I know they sent us 1.5 million AstraZenecas. How did this cross-border vaccine initiative with North Dakota come about? Give us the details of that.
Well, you know, we have a really close relationship with North Dakota here in Manitoba, and I have a very good relationship with Doug Burgum, who's the governor, of course, down there. So we just thought we'd give Doug a call and see what would happen. We knew early on that they were going to have a max vax situation way before us. We thought maybe there was an opportunity here to assist some of our essential workers that have to travel, of course, cross border and are, vulnerable. And so Doug was able to accommodate us with the support of the president's office, I'm told, and that's great news for Manitobans. I think it's great news for our trucking industry, and potentially I hope we can build on this concept with other state governments and provincial governments across the country.
Yeah, it's incredible that they've vaccinated so many people in North Dakota that they can afford, and they want to vaccinate between 2,000 and 4,000 workers who are crossing the border, truckers and other folks who are crossing back and forth on that border because they have the surplus, not costing a dime, I understand, for either Manitoba or Canada. Is that right?
That's right, because, of course, under their disaster system, this is covered. They are coordinating at their end with a truck stop just south of the Canada-U.S. border that work our drivers that are coming back from return routes into the United States will be able to get not only having their first vaccine, but also in time, based on the manufacturer's sequencing, they'll get their second vaccine 3 or 4 weeks later as well. So that's great, great news. We don't want that border to be a barrier ever. You know, I'm a kind of a free trade guy, and I know that we have to have safety restrictions and border restrictions. We all do for now, but you know, we shouldn't let that border get in the way of cross-border cooperation when it's so common sense.
Would North Dakota be open to doing this for tourists?
Don't know. Doug had that question raised to him by a U.S. reporter earlier today, and I think they'd be open to that. We're here looking more at essential people that we'd like to get down there, shorten our waits, obviously. Here in Manitoba, of course, we've been working really hard, like everybody has, to get vaccines out to our vulnerable communities, in particular our PCHs, all covered now twice, and our northern communities, a lot of Indigenous communities in Manitoba that are vulnerable, as you know, and so we've been getting it out there, but we got our age dropping down, but we'd all like to have these vaccines sooner, yeah, not later. And you know, we do have a differential, as you know, and this is not to knock the feds. It's just a fact that the vaccine availability here is a lot less than it was, yeah, in the States. So why stop the flow of such a common sense thing if we can have our because we do business together. We don't compete so much as we build things together our two countries.
I understand Saskatchewan's now talking to North Dakota as well, but did you talk to the federal government and said, hey, this is working, there's a lot of cross-border traffic around essential workers, there's real concern about the variants. Why don't you coordinate this with other border states? Why don't you talk to Michigan? Why don't you talk to other states that are along the border that may also have a similar situation in North Dakota?
Yeah, well, we have communicated that to premiers and to the prime minister, and we'll continue to push it. We think this could be a good, you want to call it a pilot project, but I think it's a good indication of where we can work together. I know that my premier colleagues have good working relationships with their neighbors. I think this is something that, makes sense and can give us a little bit of a breakthrough advantage here because, look, the sooner that we can get those border restrictions down between Canada and the U.S., yeah, the sooner we can start building our economies back up, create jobs, get people going. And tourism, of course, is a big deal for both countries. And we all love, right, here in Manitoba, we like a little trip once in a while to Fargo or Grand Forks, do some shopping. And they love to come up for a Jets game, watch a good hockey team instead of what you guys have to deal with down there.
Yeah, and I listen, you're not in first place, but that's okay. Let me ask you something real quick. How about vaccine passports? Is that something that North Dakota is talking about that here we'll share now, but we're going to be implementing a vaccine passport soon?
No, they're not. We have had conversation about it. I don't think they're very receptive to it, Evan. I know the prime minister said he isn't as well. It's not our first choice is just to get people back vaccinated, and we're promoting the heck out of that. We know there's some reluctance from some Canadians to do that, but we're trying to tackle that with every measure we can, because we know that that herd immunity thing, the sooner that actually happens, the sooner we can get back to a semblance of our previous real lives. Right.
Real quick, the budget was yesterday. The big pillar of it, of course, the proposed national child care program. That is, of course, provincial jurisdiction. I spoke to the finance minister. She said, I'm going to have to negotiate with them. We have $30 billion over 5 years as a carrot. Do you want this program? What will you say when you sit down and negotiate with the federal government?
Well, if you want us to have faith in your future partnership and the sustainability of a partnership on child care, be a better partner on health care in the first place. And the fact of the matter is the feds have kind of dropped the ball on that, as you know.
They didn't give you the $28 billion that you wanted. I know they said they've already given the Safe Restart program and they've increased it. But I know you wanted the more money on that. But what's your take on the child care, though?
Well, my take is that one size fits all probably don't work, and it doesn't work in this country very often. But that dialogue on this important issue is important. We have child care needs. They're growing. We have also, though, the reason they're growing and the reason the importance of getting people back into the workforce is growing is because people are retiring. And as those people retire, they tend to need a hip. They tend to need knee surgery. They tend to need a cataract replaced, fixed. So, look, we can do both. We can walk and chew gum. Let's do it.
But we'll strengthen
the health care system. Make that a priority. If you don't care about wait times, then you love that budget. Okay. I care about wait times.
Okay, but just real quick, will you try to find a size that fits on child care? They've got $30 billion over 5 years. Even Chrystia Freeland said today, I know it's not one size fits all. Are you going to look for a size that fits Manitoba?
Oh, totally. I mean, I think every province is open to that. We're all aware of the needs for additional child care.
Right.
What I heard yesterday was the feds want to make it less pricey for everybody that has child care. My preference would be to make child care available to those who don't have it. We've got wait times here in this country. So, you know, design matters, details matter, and that dialogue has to happen. But you and I both know it's a pre-election budget. If you believe all the promises in that budget, you probably don't remember the previous budget pre-election, right? You don't remember electoral reform. You don't remember pharmacare. You don't remember a lot of things. I remember all those things. So I'm ready for the dialogue on home care and health care and seniors' homes and every other issue. But I also would like to see our health care system, which is the foundation of our social structure, strengthened and sustained, and this is long overdue, and it was ignored yesterday.
All right, I got to leave it there, Premier. I will give you one thing. The Jets are having a pretty good season, second place in the North. Thanks, Premier.
Wait till we get Wheeler back.
All right, that was my conversation yesterday with the Premier of Manitoba. Coming up, it was a rare conviction of a police officer, but will yesterday's guilty verdict of former police officer Derek Chauvin in the murder of George Floyd lead to any fundamental change? Why is that kind of conviction so rare? Sandy Hudson, the co-founder of Black Lives Matter Toronto, weighs in next. Stay with us.
Tears of joy. Tears of joy.
And what does it feel like now seeing them march down the street?
It's a blessing that we still be able to get out here and be able to speak our mind for justice that was served today. We made a change today. It's history.
You got it, baby.
The reaction to yesterday when the jury found former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin guilty, second-degree murder, third-degree murder, second-degree manslaughter, and George Floyd's death. It was a trial that gripped the world after video of Chauvin ramming his knee into George Floyd's neck for more than 7.5 minutes. Global protests were sparked against police violence, and there's been an investigation and a reckoning into how that has happened and why it continues to happen. But why was Chauvin's guilty verdict such a rare occurrence in the United States? And what lessons can Canada learn from this ordeal, especially about what we really know about police violence in Canada? Do we even have the right information needed to confront the issue? Let's find out. Joining us now is Sandy Hudson, co-founder of Black Lives Matter Toronto and Akwasi Owusu-Bempah, sociology professor at the University of Toronto, who studies this issue. Good to have both of you back. Akwasi, let me just start with you, because you and I spoke earlier today. Like, just give me a reaction to the verdict yesterday, but the lesson Canadians need to draw from that and what we've seen in the United States that's so resonant here in Canada.
Yeah, my reaction to the verdict, I'm relieved, but I remain angry, saddened. I find little kind of happiness in the fact that the Chauvin was convicted. George Floyd is still dead. The verdict does not bring him back. And so, you know, I take a little solace in the actual verdict itself. But I do, you know, as I said, experience some relief from that. History has not been so kind in similar cases. As we discussed earlier on, we don't have the data, and even the data in the United States is spotty and problematic, but we simply don't have comprehensive data on police use of force and on deaths at the hands of police in this country. And that is, you know, something that needs to change if we're going to fully understand and acknowledge how police use force. The little bit of information the information that we do have shows that people with mental health problems and Black and Indigenous people are overrepresented in use of force and in deaths at the hands of police, but it is not nearly as comprehensive as it could be.
Yeah, let me bring in Sandy. Sandy, you were with me as we chronicled that last night, as we watched the verdict, and I saw, and we all listened to your reaction. But when you listen to Akwasi say, we don't even have the information on this kind of situation in Canada. We're trying to confront a problem, but how do you confront a problem that we may not have a good handle on? What do we need to know here in Canada before we can even come to terms with this properly?
Well, I would caution us on thinking that we need to wait to take action. I mean, I think while I agree with Dr. Owusu-Bempah about the data that we need, you know, in Black Lives Matter Canada, we've been trying to gather what we can on police use of force in Canada across the country, and it's been so hard because the data just isn't there. But we can take action even if we don't have that data. These are two things that need to happen at the same time. And I mean, Evan, you've heard me say this so many times, it's the thing we need to do is to take away the power from the police to terrorize, harm, and kill Black communities. And that looks like defunding the police. And I think we've got to do that at the same time that we are ramping up efforts to collect the necessary data that we need to properly understand the situation.
Yeah, you talked about that, Akwasi, and I think Sandy's making a great point. We don't need to start everything on first base here. We know a lot, even though I think both of you have said, and I don't think maybe anybody appreciates why it is so difficult to get this information. Like, I know, Akwasi, you've been trying to study this. Sandy's been trying to study this. What is holding back police who are paid for by the public just giving out this information so the public has it?
I think a reluctance to be, you know, held under a microscope and to be scrutinized. I think that goes not only for police agencies and those that oversee them, the boards, but also the government itself, right? We have a national crime data collection system that's run by Statistics Canada. We could have something very similar done with respect to use of force data. And I agree with, you know, Sandy's point. We do not need to wait for the data to take action. There have been several, specialized studies in Toronto, in Ontario. We see patterns similar to those that emerge in the United States. And so we understand at a basic level, you know, what contributes to the overrepresentation of Black and Indigenous people suffering from mental health problems in police use of force. We could certainly know a lot more.
Yeah, Sandy, and I think we've all made this point, you made it eloquently yesterday, this verdict is not going to change. There's a lot of change to happen. This is one verdict. But just take it here to Canada. How does this apply every day to Canada? And I know you talked about the defunding issue, but how else is Canada impacted by the verdict on the Chauvin case?
Well, I think we can compare some of the information that you talked about at the just at the top of the segment here. Very rarely do police in America go to trial. Also here, very rarely are the actions of police looked at in the court of law, because there are these bodies, these interim bodies in between like the SIU or who are stopping those cases from going to a court of law, or attorney generals who are resistant to taking a look at what the police are doing in the courts. And so there's very little by the way of accountability, and we can, you know, take the experience from the United States and understand that that is also similar here in Canada. And when you have that kind of lack of accountability, when you have the resistance that Dr. Owusu-Bempah just talked about to being held accountable, I think we really have to take a look at our politicians and say, what are you doing? Where are you on this? It's them that have the power to force these changes at Statistics Canada, to force police agencies to take this data down and to remove power from the police to harm our communities. But they're not doing that. They are not prioritizing this issue. And one should ask at this point, why? Why? It's popular. These are popular ideas.
Right. Okay, this is a conversation that we're just beginning. We're not ending, and we continue to have it. And I always want to thank Sandy Hudson from Black Lives Matter Toronto and Professor Owusu-Bempah, always available to help us out. Thanks, guys. I really appreciate that. We got lots to come on this program. Coming up next, measures, taking measures into their own hands. Toronto and Peel Region are trying to crack down on COVID-19 and how that's spreading in the workplace. Why are they moving ahead without the province? Peel's top doctor, Lawrence Lowe, joins us next. Stay with us. Welcome back to the program. Ontario, Toronto, Peel Region, they're striking out on their own because they're cracking down on the COVID-19 spread in workplaces. It's just so bad there. The two public health units are now going to require businesses with five or more recent cases of COVID to shut down for 10 days. This comes after a flood of criticism against the Ontario government for its latest round of new health public health restrictions that did not include paid sick days, did not include shutting down of workplaces with COVID spread. Has the province lost authority to govern key parts of their own province in the crisis? I'm going to bring the press gallery in to talk about that. Robert Benzie is the Toronto Star's Queen's Park Bureau Chief, Rachel Aiello, CTV News online parliamentary reporter, and our special guest, who's actually in a mobile studio, also known as his car, is Dr. Lawrence Lowe, the Peel Region Chief Medical Officer of Health, who's literally driving home from his press conference with the mayor of Mississauga, Bonnie Crombie. Welcome to all of you, Dr. Lowe. First of all, thanks for pulling over and doing this. Your mobile studio looks great. Toronto and Peel are directing businesses to close if COVID-19 workplace outbreaks happen. That goes against what the province had said. Why take this kind of independent step?
Well, I don't know that it goes against the province necessarily. I really do think the province and our public health unit share the same goal, which is really to try to bring this third wave under control, vaccinate our communities, and see our way out of this. So I think, you know, we worked with Toronto Public Health on the Section 22 order with a recognition that a lot of the workplaces that have remained open in our communities, certainly in Peel, the outbreaks that we're seeing are spreading further and faster with the variants. And it's necessitating a bit of a treatment more like we were doing with schools, where if cases are detected early, that an automatic dismissal, sending folks home to interrupt transmission and to keep people safe is a more effective and optimal way, perhaps, to respond at this point in the pandemic.
Robert Benzie, let me just weigh in. I spoke to Bonnie Crombie late last week. She was stunned by the measures that the Ontario government had brought down. She said they're keeping too many workplaces open as if they're essential, and they're not. They're targeting the wrong things like playgrounds. And now here they are making their own rules here because they just think they're better served by that. Has Doug Ford and the Ontario government kind of lost their way here in terms of guidance in this crisis?
Well, that certainly is a sentiment that a lot of people are sharing right now, Evan. And I think what Dr. Lowe did and what Dr. Eileen Davila here in Toronto did was they used Section 22 of the Health Protection and Promotion Act. So that's provincial legislation that allows them to close workplaces to do a lot of health measures that they can take if they feel that it's for public safety, public health. But I think that when the image of local medical officers' health, like Dr. Lowe and Dr. Davila, taking matters into their own hands is not a great look for Premier Doug Ford, who himself is in isolation. He's quarantining at home right now because one of his key aides has COVID-19. He found out last night. Mr. Ford, who's had an AstraZeneca shot, like you and I haven't, he is tested negative, Ford has, but the staffer has tested negative or positive. So under the Toronto public health guidelines, he has to remain under quarantine for 14 days. Right. So this is a really complicated time for Mr. Ford's government and for Ontarians in general. The pandemic is not going well right now here.
Yeah. So I just want our viewers to be clear. Premier Ford has tested negative.
Tested positive.
Yeah. I just want to make sure that's clear. Rachel Aiello, let me go to you. Mixed messages. We've seen it from all, by the way, this is not exclusive to Ontario, all over the place. What has been the cost of it when people say, what's open, what's closed, shut down, not shut down, open? We're seeing it on the question of stopping flights from India. I just talked to Bill Blair about that. What does that tell you about how this crisis is being handled?
Well, it's causing pandemic fatigue and a lot of doubt in the efficacy of government's measures. Like, we're talking about flights. How many times have we had conversations with people questioning whether the quarantine measures are actually going far enough? Obviously, we have variants in this country and more continue to come. So that's an indication that, yes, while there are tests and quarantines, it's still getting through. And so when we're seeing this, more conversations and delays or deliberations, like we heard from Bill Blair earlier, wondering whether or not they're going to go further in terms of addressing what's coming from India, it leads to frustration. Because how many times, Evan, have we heard from these people, we have learned lessons, we will, you know, act better, act faster. And here we are 14 months later, and we're still having the same kind of conversations.
I've heard more callers today, Dr. Lowe, on the radio saying, wait, I can't take a walk outside with my neighbor in a park, but flights can come from India. Or can you just give us the data? I know provinces are imposing interprovincial checkpoints at borders between Ontario, Quebec, and Manitoba, and BC's considering it as well. The government's contemplating restricting flights from India because of the new variant. And now you've put new restrictions in on workplaces. How important are restricting international or intra-provincial travel to limiting the spread, or are those minor?
Well, I think they're all very important measures. And I think the reality is we have a significant widespread propagated community transmission in Peel, in Toronto, in York Region, in the midst of a very significant third wave. And it's going to be measures that are that address spread in places like workplaces that remain open, that address things like broader community transmission that are going to be absolutely vital. But we do know that there are other places in the world where this disease is not under control. I mean, the curve in India looks more like a wall, frankly, and the variant there is certainly of significant concern. So to prevent introductions, I think the border is certainly something that I would encourage our federal counterparts to take a closer look at, even as we're dealing with a bit of a significant brush fire in our own backyard.
Yeah, take a look at the border and listen to the science advice. Dr. Lowe, Chief Medical Officer of Health in Ontario Peel's region, they're going it alone. Thanks for pulling over. We'll take you wherever we can get you in the mobile studio, which looks great. Benz and Rach, just hang in there. I want you to stick around. The government's facing a confidence motion. We're going to talk about that. Also, a Bloc Quebecois MP has apologized for taking a photo of a Liberal MP who appeared nude in a non-public view of the virtual House of Commons last week, but says he doesn't know how it was leaked. In a statement to the chamber today, Bloc MP Sebastian Lemire admitted he did take a photo of fellow Quebec MP Will Amos, who was changing in his office following a jog and did not realize the camera was on. We're obviously not showing that photo. All right, coming up, it's a budget pack with stimulus, but should Canada spend so much money when the Bank of Canada today projected big economic growth? Mustafa Askari joins the press gallery. We're going to dig into the numbers next. Stay with us. A pretty sunny forecast for Canada's economic growth. Yes, Bank of Canada is predicting, get this, 6.5% increase this year. That's a red-hot economy. Despite the pandemic's turbulence and the third wave, the Bank of Canada Governor Tiff Macklem warns pandemic recovery after that will cool off a bit and still need extraordinary kind of support. But if Canada is expecting such rapid growth, does the government really need to spend $101 billion over the next 3 years to stimulate? Press Gallery is going to dig into this. Robert Benzi from the Toronto Star is back. So is Rachel Aiello, our online producer for CTV's Parliamentary Bureau. And Mustafa Askari is the chief economist at the Institute of Fiscal Studies and Democracy, formerly part of the Parliamentary Budget Office. Great to have you all back. Mr. Askari, great to have you here.
Thank you very much.
6.5% growth. I can't even remember the last time Canada had that kind of prediction, honestly, almost ever. What do you make of that growth and then the promise still to stimulate? Is that still smart?
Well, first of all, certainly it's a strong forecast. In fact, over the 3 years up to 2023, their projection is about 1.5 to 2% higher GDP, real GDP, than what the government had in the budget. So it's a pretty substantial increase in GDP. Now, they do have the stimulus actually included in their forecast. They have $85 billion of the stimulus included in their forecast. So some of that increase that you see is coming from that stimulus money. So they also make sure to say that there's still considerable uncertainty out there. And we still have a lot of excess capacity in the economy that needs to be absorbed. So it's still a question of whether we need that stimulus or not. But I think, given the uncertainty, I think the government is erring on the side of caution, and they want to make sure that we are not going to slow down the economy.
Right, Rachel. I don't remember a time when spending $101 billion extra money is erring on the side of caution. But I guess we're in a new world here. Does that growth and fear of overheating an economy throw into question the promise to spend in this new budget?
Well, it's going to be a question they face for a long time, Evan. When you think about some of these promises, 500,000 jobs over 5 years, more affordable childcare by 2030, these are long-term promises, and they're going to keep facing these questions until they can show that it's working. And it seems like it's going to take a number of years for some of these big ticket, big money items to follow through on and show their return on investment, I guess you could say. So I think it's something that they're going to have to find new ways to communicate out of in the short term, because I'm not sure over the next, year or so, when other economies are starting to beat us back to normal, they're going to have the proof to show the money they're spending is returning investment. Actually, it was interesting today. I read a piece from someone who used to advise Morneau on budgets and a former Trudeau advisor. And he basically said the spending, the stimulus, was a political solution in search of an economic problem. So when they're getting that kind of criticism from former Liberal staffers, it's definitely something they're going to have to continue to try to prove that their approach is the right one.
Let me just focus on the politics and then I'll go to you, Robert Benzi. Right now, there's a confidence motion on that. There's going to be a couple votes on this based on some amendments that the Conservatives and then the NDP made. This is a live look at Parliament. This is a vote on this. The Liberals declared this a confidence motion. The NDP are going to have 3 members vote against it, but the rest will vote with the government on this. And so the government will not fall, but they've got in about 8 minutes and 31 seconds, you'll get the results. The government's not going to fall, by the way, so I'm going to tell you the ending of the story because the NDP have already given that away. Ben, the key here is the child care, $30 billion over 5 years for this. It's provincial jurisdiction. Is Ontario going to bite on that?
Well, not yet. This is the thing, Evan. $10 a day daycare sounds great in theory, but when you have 9 provinces that have to buy in, Quebec, of course, already has its $10 a day daycare program, which is kind of the template that the federal government would like to see in other provinces. It's going to be a challenge. The federal government right now only contributes about 2.5% of the cost of childcare in Ontario. So the Ontario government, when Chrystia Freeland's budget came out the other day, was saying, this is great in theory, but remember, we foot most of the tab. So I think it's going to be a tricky negotiation. This is not something that will be done overnight. But we know from different economic studies that the more people that can get into the workforce with cheaper daycare, the better your society is, the better your economy does. So I think there will be a political will to do that.
Okay, but I just want to focus. I got a minute here. The idea is that if you spend $30 billion, it's a big economic booster, childcare. But in their own budget, Mr. Ascari, and I'm reading this from the Liberals' budget, they say if you invest $30 billion into childcare, at least, you know what the economic growth is? And I'll show you the graph here. You're going to get economic growth of 0.05% per year over the two next decades for a total of 1.2%. Like 0.05% a year. Is that, are they overselling? I'm not suggesting it's a bad or good program, but are they overselling the economic benefit of childcare here for that kind of money?
Well, in fact, one could argue that they're underestimating the impact, because there are studies out there that that show the impact would be higher. But again, I think they're being careful not to show too much of an impact, because, you know, they could be criticized for that. I think 1.2% increase in the level of GDP over time, it is significant. That 1.2% is an increase in potential GDP, which means that it is a permanent increase in output in the economy. So overall, right, it is a positive, right, impact. There is no doubt. But there are uncertainties. Okay. Again, even that, it depends on how people behave.
Okay. I got to leave it here, guys. We ran out of time, and we're watching that. Mr. Ascari, Rachel, and Ben, it's great to have the three of you on the program. Lots to watch for, and thank you for spending your time watching us. We'll be back here in 23 short hours. If it's safe, and I hope it is, hug your loved ones, get the shot. We'll see you back here tomorrow.